Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness. Brought to you by Forever Family Foundation, on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I call your name, the echo is haunting, the echo is always the same. I call your name, the echo is haunting, an echo can never be changed. So I call your name, your name.
And welcome to Signs of Life Radio. I'm your host, Bob Ginsberg, and I'm here today with an old friend of the foundation, Dr. Jeff Tarrant. Jeff is the founder and director of Psychic Mind Science and the Neuromeditation Institute in Eugene, Oregon. He's a licensed psychologist and board certified in neurofeedback. His research focuses on exploring brainwave changes that occur as a result of contemplative practices, also technological interventions and non-ordinary states of consciousness and psi abilities. Dr. Tarrant is trained extensively in psychedelic integration therapy, works with two physicians to provide ketamine assistant therapy. He is the author of the new book I just mentioned, Becoming Psychic, Lessons from the Minds of Mediums, Healers, and Psychics. His previous book, Meditation Interventions to Rewire the Brain. His website is neuromeditationinstitute.com. And welcome back to Signs of Life, Jeff. It's been too long.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess I have to start off by asking, I know you have some degree of intuitive ability yourself. Your interest in all this stuff, way back when, was that to explore your own intuitiveness, or were you just simply curious about the subject?
Well, I mean, when I kind of got back into this, 11 or 12 years ago, which is probably about when we first met, probably something like that. I really wasn't looking for any of this. I wasn't exploring this for myself, even though I've always, to a large degree, I've had interests in these things for myself off and on most of my life. But really, I stumbled into this from meeting Janet Mayer, who obviously has been involved with Forever Family, gosh, since the beginning, right? Yeah.
Just about,
yeah. And, I jokingly blame Janet for me kind of getting into this field. I met her and had an opportunity to map her brain. And then kind of one thing led to another. And so, over the last 10 years have been kind of doing both, exploring my own abilities and then also trying to understand this from more of a scientific perspective.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned Janet because, I mean, some of the members, know a bit about Janet. And for those who don't, she suddenly began speaking ancient languages, specifically of the Yanomami tribe, which is an ancient tribe in the Amazon. So I imagine that working with Janet was fascinating to you and might have spurred you on to do a lot more research. In short, it must have blew your mind.
And to be fair, when I was first introduced to Janet and her abilities, I didn't know Janet. I didn't know any of this research. I didn't know any of this work. And so there was certainly a part of my mind that was kind of going like, well, there's probably an explanation for this, right? For what Janet's able to do. Is she really, channeling languages from, a South American tribe? Is that what's going on? Or is there some other more logical explanation? And so I kind of went into it with a fair amount of skepticism. Not that I was doubting Janet, but, those of you that know Janet, she's very open to like, hey, I don't know what's going on. I'm trying to figure this out. And, but after I met Janet and started working with her and heard what she did and heard the story and spent some time with her, it was like, okay, yeah, there's no doubt that there's something very interesting going on here that, doesn't fit with anything that we really know about, you know, the way that these languages kind of work. And, you know, it's not glossolalia. It's not xenoglossy. It's not any of these other things that people have talked about before. And so, yeah, it did blow my mind. You know, once I kind of came to the realization and finally accepted, you know, that it's like, okay, this is beyond anything I've seen before. Then it was like, okay, I'm in. You know, what else can we do? Yeah. And that's when I met you.
Yeah, I could see that really being influential in your future research in this field. I've always been fascinated with this brain as a filter model, you know, which was talked about 100 years ago, really. And you know, the theory being that, and we only observe less than 1% of the universe, and we're surrounded by information fields. And if we didn't have a filter, we wouldn't be able to navigate our lives, right? So your work, you know, appears to show that reception of things like psychic information is enhanced, and we can put our so-called, you know, conscious mind aside and get into some sort of a zone and some sort of altered state of consciousness. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, it's I'd say yes, and I'll clarify just a little bit, at least some of the way I'm thinking about it. But certainly one of the things that we've seen repeatedly with mediums and psychics is that certain parts of the brain seem to shut down when they're engaged in their work. And so that supports this idea, right? That certain parts of the brain are kind of getting out of the way. And so we see that. We also see this pretty dramatic shift in a lot of people to the right hemisphere, which also kind of supports this, because the left hemisphere is so much based in analysis and language and, you know, sort of organizing information with the logical mind. And so we see this shift away from the left hemisphere into different patterns in the right hemisphere. So that part I totally agree with, and more understand the brain as, yeah, a filter, sort of a limiting, a reducing valve, as, you know, Aldous Huxley called it. You know, and at the same time, this idea of kind of shifting into an altered state, you know, it's interesting because a lot of the mediums that I've worked with, they certainly don't look like they're in an altered state when they're doing their work, although they describe themselves as being sort of a light trance, right? So, you know, I guess that's an altered state. You're not quite in your normative consciousness.
Yeah. And, you know, altered state is such a kind of a vague term because, I mean, you're an expert in meditative practices. And, I mean, things like art and music could be a form of meditation, right? A walk through nature. I mean, you know, it's nothing that you would notice, but people, they set their mind aside, the chatter mind, and they get into a zone, right? So, and so, the, you know, getting back to the brain's influence. So that's what I always wondered, you know, since I started reading about all this stuff, is that you talked about setting, you know, the brain aside, so to speak, you know, and letting information flow. Might there be an area in the brain, you've certainly identified some that go dark, you know, and light up, that we can study to help us learn how to create our own communications or intuitiveness? You know, I mean, I think you touched on it in your new book. But there have been a lot of people that have studied things like DMT. You know, I talked to Rick Strassman about, you know, about that, and the body, theoretically, in the pineal gland, you know, has this psychoactive substance. You know, why? You know,
and right,
that all species. So maybe that could play a role and teach us how. After all, we're all looking to. I shouldn't say we're all, but a lot of us are looking for ways to enhance our own communications and psychic abilities. So do you think that the brain is not only a receiver of information, but it might initiate these things?
It's a really interesting question, right? Because, you know, the like kind of what you're bringing up, that there's, you know, the brain, you know, we create our own psychedelic neurotransmitters, you know, in the brain, that, you know, it's kind of like, why would we do that? Why would the brain create a psychedelic substance, and then it also creates another substance to inhibit it. And it's like, well, that's a lot of work for the brain to do for no reason, right? And there's, as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing in our physiology that happens for no reason. You know, everything's there for a purpose. And so why would we do that? And so to me, it suggests that it's a natural thing, right? That we access in sort of certain heightened states, right? Under crisis or at the moment of death, perhaps. There's some evidence that maybe that's what's happening. When you look at like bursts of gamma brainwaves that happen at the moment of death. And it's like, well, what's that about? And, you know, there's some mediums and psychics that I've looked at that their brain looks very similar to what you see in a psychedelic state when they're engaged in this practice. You know, the certain parts of the brain that we haven't talked about yet, like really drop out in such a way that it seems to allow this additional information to come in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and actually just recently I was having a conversation with somebody talking about, you know, a psychic that they're working with who apparently is very gifted. And when this person saw pictures, images of that people have drawn of like their DMT experiences in ayahuasca, this person was like, oh my God, like that's what I see. Like that's, you know. And so, you know, I think that's really fascinating because I've never considered that before, that until this conversation, you know, not the conversation I was just talking about, that maybe that is what they're seeing. Like, you know, they're seeing kind of into this other realm that, you know, most of us would have to use some sort of psychedelic substance in order to access it. Yeah. But maybe some people can just kind of tap into it, right?
You're right. And, you know, and I mentioned in the introduction that you're doing research, you know, on you know, ketamine assisted therapy. Now, you know, back in the day when I was going to college, you know, it was the Timothy Leary days, and, you know, and there was a lot of research that was going on then. And then that type of those substances were not allowed in research anymore, and they were legally, you know, banned. And now, it's coming back in the mainstream again in a big way. And and therapists and mental health professionals are coming to the realization that they see real progress in their patients. So I assume that you're noticing the same things. I mean, it has a positive effect on grief.
Yeah.
You know, what kind of work are you doing in that area? You're working in a controlled setting with patients?
Yeah. Yeah. Several years ago, I was actually, when I first started formally doing that kind of work with psychedelic medicines, I was actually training and working with a peyote church. And, you know, peyote is legal in, I think, 6 or 7 states if it's used in a spiritual context. And, you know, this was working with a Native woman who has access to this medicine and did it in a traditional way. And so I kind of started with that kind of work. And then, you know, have shifted more recently into working with ketamine, which is a different, you know, technically it's not even a psychedelic. It's an anesthetic, but it does have these psychedelic properties. And yeah, doing it in a very controlled setting in the office. You know, a physician, you know, oversees, you know, the process and writes the prescription, and, you know, everything is sort of done in a very methodical way so that to facilitate people having a positive, growthful experience. And one of the things you mentioned that I actually wasn't expecting, and it just, I stumbled upon because of a couple of my clients, is that it does seem to be really useful for grief. In fact, I had one client in particular. I was seeing them for something completely unrelated to grief. And in the process of us working together, they actually lost both a pet that was like their best friend. And then they also lost a family member who was very close to them, like within the span of a couple of weeks. And when they came in and told me this, and of course they were very distraught and upset, and you know, initially I said, do you think we need to have a ketamine session today or should we wait? Right. Like, you know, I don't know if you're in the best shape, right, for this. And they said, no, I want to do it. Okay, great. And then when they got into the session, they ended up having contact with, you know, with both their pet and with this family member, and having a great conversation in that state and coming out and feeling a sense of, you know, relief and connection and reconnecting to their own spirituality. And I was like, wow, okay. Like, I couldn't have planned that any better. And, you know, I was trying to discourage him, you know, so.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it certainly spurs you on to want to explore that more. You know, you reminded me when you were talking about kind of a funny story. We had started the foundation, it was, you know, for a year or two, and obviously this kind of work was consuming my life, you know, and my wife Fran's life. We were always talking about this stuff. And my daughter was in college, and she came home on vacation, and she looked at, you know, Fran and I, and she said, look, I got to tell you something. I brought home this stuff, you know, she said, it's called salvia. And first I'll tell you, I haven't done it. But the reason I brought it home is that all my friends are doing it. And when they do it, they sound just like you and mom. They start talking about the afterlife and the things that they're seeing. That made us really curious, you know. So it was then that we knew that, you know, there may be portals to the unknown. Listen, I know you've always been an explorer personally, you know, both from a personal point perspective and from a researcher, you know, scientist. And I was reminded of it when I was reviewing your book that, you were once at my home and I had, you know, built the psychomantium. And for those who don't know what a psychomantium is, it's based on the ancient Greeks, and they use sensory deprivation. They used to go into dimly lit, you know, caves and look in reflecting pools and would report communicating with their ancestors and deceased loved ones. And there were modern day researchers, you know, Raymond Moody, you know, when I flew out to visit with Dr. Arthur Hastings, who's no longer in this physical world, and kind of modeled his psychomantium, and we built it. And you had the opportunity to go in. I had totally forgot about that. But I had forgot that you had some profound experiences in there, right? You remember? Yeah. You remember what they were?
I do. Well, I remember some of it anyway. But and I hooked my brain up too, you know, when I went in, because why not? Right. I had my equipment with me and it was interesting because, you know, we didn't do a whole sort of traditional setup for me going in, like, you know, like it's been designed, like Moody did, right? Some of his research. But, you know, I just kind of jumped in there and was like, okay, we'll see what happens.
Well, you did.
Yeah. 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 And I think I was in there about 45 minutes or so. And boy, it didn't take long of being in there before, yeah, I felt different, right? I mean, I remember feeling like energetically very buzzy and almost like I wanted to move, right? I was like, whoa, man, there's so much energy. What's going on here? But at the same time, felt kind of spacey. And it was like, okay, you know, because your eyes are open in this completely dark room and you're staring up at this mirror that's kind of up at the top corner of the room. And yeah, you know, I mean, I saw an image of my great grandfather that who had passed, that I, you know, I wasn't thinking of him. I wasn't expecting that. I heard a voice, you know, kind of giving me some information. You know, I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember the exact quote, but it was basically something like, you know, you're always loved or something like that. And it was like, okay, cool. You know, and saw flashes of light and all kinds of weird stuff. And so, yeah, it was pretty heavy. And I remember coming out of there and being very disoriented.
And that's why, as you alluded to, I mean, you're supposed to have a spotter sitting outside, and, you know, it can be, even though the it's enclosed by a dark sheet, basically. You know, a lot of people can get claustrophobic, but, you know, what, you know, I once put, I'm much like you, and, you know, with that stuff, I mean, I'd like to do experiments. I had two mediums in the house, and I put both of them in there. I moved the second chair in, with instructions that they weren't allowed to talk to each other. And that as soon as they came out, I was going to separate them and give them each a legal pad. And I asked them to each write down their experiences. And someday, I don't have time to tell you about it, but someday I have to, because it's quite extraordinary, you know what happens. So, but yeah, you've also done work with the Gonsfeld technique, right? So tell our listeners a little bit about that. You know, what's Gonsfeld and how does it work?
Yeah. So, Gonsfeld, is roughly translated to whole field. And, the way it was originally done was, you take a ping pong ball and cut it in half and tape each half over one eyeball so that you can keep your eyes open. And then you're shining this red light on the face. And so what happens is that the ping pong balls create this a field effect, right? Like it diffuses everything. So that you just have this giant field of red. And so kind of like the being in all black, right? It's like, you're kind of messing with your visual senses in a way. And then typically you would also listen to like white noise at the same time, which I think has another similar kind of effect, right? White noise has all of the auditory frequencies at the same caliber. And so you're kind of flooding the senses with information, but it's all meaningless. There's nothing there. And, it's a technique that's been around for quite a while and actually used in a lot of psi research, especially with like telepathy and things like that. Right. And, we've kind of modernized it with some audio visual entrainment glasses that, so you don't have to put ping pong balls on your eyes and all that stuff. You can just put the glasses on and set it to Gonsfeld. There's actually a Gonsfeld setting and you pick the colors of the lights you want. And so it's an easier way to do this. And yeah, we've been experimenting with having people do it and just, kind of like my Psychomantium experience, not really giving them a lot of instruction, just like, okay, here, do this and tune in. Let's see what happens, right? And it's been fascinating to see, I would say the majority of people, certainly not everybody, but if I had to pick a number, maybe 60 or 70% of people come out of that with some pretty interesting experiences. Some of them full-blown, contact with other, energies and stories and journeys and all kinds of stuff that they come back reporting.
Are you also measuring their brain waves while they're doing? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Not all the time, but sometimes. And that's interesting too. And I'll kind of circle back to that. But, when we do it with people who already identify as being a medium or a psychic, it's interesting because pretty consistently they report it being like an immediate doorway into kind of getting into that space. And so the people that I used it with in this regard, they're not professional. Well, I guess one of them was a professional medium, but most of them are sort of, they work with this, but it's not something, they've got a day job, right? And they, and so some of them, it like takes them a minute to get into that state. They might have to meditate or they might have to do some sort of self hypnosis or something to kind of get there. And they all kind of reported like, whoa, this was like, just like hypercharge me right into that space. I didn't have to do anything. And interestingly, their brainwave patterns, what it looks like it does is sort of exaggerate their baseline brainwave patterns. So whatever's happening when they're just hanging out, it just ramps it up. And so that kind of fits for me, right? Of them talking about it being a quick way and a quick step into the doorway because their brains are already oriented toward this kind of work, at least a little bit. And then this just like ramps it up. Mm-hmm. But I suspect that's also why it doesn't work with everybody, because if you take somebody whose brain isn't particularly oriented toward this work and you put the glasses on them, it's like, well, it might amplify something, but it's not necessarily going to lead to the other world. Right.
Yeah. I mean, we're always talking about, when I say we, I mean, the general public, you always hear the expression, oh, he's left brained or she's right brained. And usually left brain people are, you think more, logical thinkers versus the right brain artistic. I was just wondering when you're doing these studies, just by looking at people's brainwaves, are you able to tell what their personalities might be like just by looking at their brains?
Not really their personalities. It's not that, it's not that specific. Yeah. You know, you can often get, cause I mean, I got into this whole field because of my work as a psychologist, and it's a nice tool to understand somebody's mental health concerns. So you can see patterns in the brainwave that suggest anxiety or depression or ADHD or trauma or whatever. But it's not, that's not perfect either, right? Cause just because you see a pattern, it's like, well, it may be there for another reason. But you know, so that's about as close as we could get to anything called a personality, with the EEG.
Right. I know that you've done some work with, Dr. Diane Powell. You might've met her at one of our conferences.
I did.
Really, you did. So, yeah. You know, she's wonderful and she's done a lot of, research with autistic savants, and you were involved with that. And it turns out that many have these, they're incredibly psychic.
So, yeah. Super psychic.
Yeah. So what did you learn from your work with her?
Well, you know, so I had the opportunity to, do EEG recordings with three different, autistic individuals, you know, ranging in age from, I think 13 to like 24 or something like that. And all three of them are, nonverbal. But they all three communicate by using a letter board and a number board so that they can spell and communicate what's going on. And, you know, the first thing, all three of them were ridiculously accurate with telepathy exercises with their primary caregiver. And when I mean ridiculously accurate, I mean like 100% accurate. You know, like if we didn't mess with the format, you know, because we would challenge and do some different things, but if we just left it alone, it didn't matter what we showed the mom. It could be a random sentence out of a book that we pulled off the shelf. It could be a 4-digit number we just made up. Didn't matter. These, you know, young adults, teenagers would get it. They'd get it right every time. And they were so fast. Like in some cases, they were pushing on the numbers like before we were done. Right. And it was like instantaneous. They just had the information. So first off, it just blew my mind. Like, you know, Janet blew my mind in one way. These guys blew my mind in another way, because I've seen some cool stuff, but I've never seen anybody be 100% accurate.
Yeah, that's statistically improbable, to say the least.
Yeah,
you know, it's insane. But so what do you theorize is happening? Are they able to tap into information fields that the rest of us can't?
I mean, I don't know if it's that we can't, but for some reason, it's much more just open for them. And, you know, and I don't know what all of the mechanisms are there. I mean, certainly Diane talks about, and I think this makes a lot of sense, that the fact that they don't use language the same way that, you know, normal speakers would use language, that may have something to do with it, right? Because, and I really like this way of thinking about it, because as soon as we use words to talk about something, we've changed it. And we've limited it, you know, because words limit the information. And I use this example all the time talking about this, but I think it's really perfect that most religions, you know, if you really dig into them, they say, well, you can't talk about God. Because as soon as you start talking about God, you've limited God. You know, as soon as you put any kind of language to describe God, you've already messed it up. Now, we do it anyway, right? Because, you know, And I think it's a perfect example, right? That as soon as we start using words, we've changed it. And actually, you see that with psychedelic experiences. People will come out sometimes and they don't want to talk about it because you can't describe it. You can't, words aren't going to convey what's there, right? So anyway, I suspect that part of what's going on is that because they're not using language in this analytic, narrative creating way, that it keeps them more open to more of what's actually happening. But then, of course, we also know that a lot of folks who are on the autism spectrum, you know, are more sensitive. Literally, they're more sensitive to information from the environment, you know, which is often why we see some of the behaviors we see, is because they can't filter in the same way that non-autistic folks can. So it might be a combination of these things, right? Not filtering the same way, and then also not using language the same way.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds logical to me. I also think that, you know, just as we hear about people that, you know, we have our known physical senses. So people that are sightless, they have enhanced hearing, you know, or other senses. And we don't even know how many senses there are, you know, and maybe, you know, with autistic children and they have, they're able to kind of, because of the way that their brain works and it's somewhat compromised in some respects, that they can tap into these other, you know, senses that many of us don't even realize that we have, you know, but whatever it is, it's certainly, you know, incredible. One thing I want to get into with you, because over the years, no matter who we talk to, the mediums, scientists, researchers, and the question always comes up, you know, what can we do to kind of enhance or increase the odds of getting our own communications? And uniformly, everybody says meditation. Meditation is the key, you know, and you know, I'm not a meditator. I mean, I've tried, and I just have too much of that chatter mind, that monkey mind, and I just, I'm probably not doing it right. So for those people that are looking to get into meditation, I know that there's a myriad of disciplines, and you know all of them. But what would be your advice to somebody to say, how should they start off in meditation?
Yeah, boy, that's a big question, isn't it?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I mean, so I think the first thing that I would say is that I think it's helpful to kind of look at meditation as being an umbrella term that encompasses a lot of different approaches, right? And really with meditation, all the different styles, what you're doing is directing your attention and your intention in specific ways. And so kind of recognizing that, well, there's different styles of meditation depending on how you're doing that, how you're directing your attention and your intention. You know, so focusing on your breathing, right? And then when the mind wanders, you bring it back. Well, that's one way. But then something like loving kindness, well, that's a meditation, but that's very different. You're directing your intention and attention in totally different ways. And so not surprisingly, they affect your brain differently. You know, your brain doesn't look the same doing a focus meditation as it does doing a loving kindness meditation. And so to some degree, it's helpful to kind of get clear on like, well, what is your goal? What are you trying to do? Why do you want to meditate? And if we understand that, then we can start to identify, well, which style of meditation is most likely to help you get there, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. What's neuro-meditation? I know you it's one of the things that you work with. So
yeah,
what's that's a style of meditation?
Well, not exactly. It's actually, there's kind of two parts to it. But the first part is kind of what we're describing, right? Is kind of understanding how different styles affect the brain differently. And, you know, we've kind of identified, and it's not just us, right? This is from the research literature that lots of researchers have looked at this, but we've kind of identified four primary styles and they affect the brain differently. And so then we look at it and go like, okay, cool. How can we help people learn how to do each of these? You know, figure out which one you want to learn. And then let's create sort of a developmental, individualized approach so that people can experiment with these different ways of engaging the mind so that they can develop some skill with this, right? And so that's one aspect. The other aspect is using technology to help get into these meditative states. So, you know, whether it's brainwave biofeedback or using other technologies, kind of nudging the brain or, you know, assisting the brain and assisting the person in getting information about what their brain is doing can be really helpful, right? Because kind of like you were describing, a lot of people, when they meditate, they're kind of like, I don't know if I'm doing this right. I have no clue if I'm, you know, am I even doing what I'm supposed to do? But if you get information on what your brain is doing in real time, well, guess what? You can figure it out pretty quick because it's kind of like, you know, it's telling you like, nope, that's not it. And like, oh, okay. and you fumble around and you find it and go like, oh, that's it. Okay. You know, now how do I get back there? Right.
Right. Yeah. I think that's where I was always struggling until I, you know, then I read that I wasn't doing it wrong. There's nothing wrong with your mind wandering as right. long as you just let it go and then, you know, get back to where you're supposed to be. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It sounds simple. And by the way, you know, I just want to mention all these things we're talking about is in Jeff's new book, Becoming Psychic, Lessons from the Minds of Mediums, Healers, and Psychics. Another thing that you talk about in the book is vibroacoustic therapy. That sounds interesting. So tell us, what's that?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and there's a bunch of devices out there on the market that do this. And the basic idea is, you're turning sound into vibration, right? And so, you know, there's several devices. Some are as simple as something that looks like a watch that you wear on your wrist. And, you know, it Bluetooth connects to your phone and you pick what kind of a program you want for relaxation, for sleep, for focus, whatever. And then the thing vibrates, you know, on your inner wrist at a certain rate, certain frequency, or a certain pattern. And, you know, so what they found is that these different kinds of tactile stimulation can have pretty profound effects on the nervous system. The way it's usually used is to induce more of a relaxation response, right? So it seems to stimulate the vagus nerve, which, if people aren't familiar, it's the 10th cranial nerve. That comes out of your brainstem and connects to basically everything in your body. And it's essentially kind of turns on the parasympathetic nervous system, right? The relax, you know, aspect of kind of how we behave. And so these vibrations seem to stimulate that and kind of get people into this really chill, nice place. So there's, you know, there's like a wrist type thing and there's, you know, there's whole beds. I've got a big giant bed in the next room that you can lay on and the whole thing vibrates, right? You know,
this is really interesting to me because, especially when we're talking about the vagus nerve, you know, I've had certain, medical episodes in my life and I wound up in the hospital and they always termed it a vasovagal episode, you know, because everything else, you know, checked out. And I'm wondering, by wearing one of those devices that stimulates the vagus nerve, whether that would be helpful, you know?
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I might ask you more about that.
Yeah.
Do you ever work with EMDR? I think you also talk about IADC in your book or induced after death communication, but do you work with either of those two?
I don't. Actually, you're the one that introduced me to
Alan Bakken.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I haven't met him, but you introduced me to his work. And so I got his book and was checking it out. I think I mentioned it in my book, but I didn't. Yeah. I haven't gone that route. I don't personally do EMDR per se. I've been exploring ways of doing something similar with you know, some of the technology. You know, so like those glasses I was talking about that do the Ganzfeld, you can also set them to different flicker rates, and you can set it so that, you know, the left and right eye fields alternate. And so, you know, literally you could put the lights on the glasses and have them go back and forth, you know, one repetition per second or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I've been kind of exploring the use of that, like, I wonder if this would be an easy way to, you know, if somebody's distressed or if there's something that they want to move through their system, just put on the glasses and, you know, and start kind of talking about what's going on. And we've tried that with other stimulation technology and it's worked. So, you know, I suspect that there's something there.
Yeah. Many years ago, I had got a hold of some of those, the Hemisync, module tapes and so forth. And that works on brain entrainment, right? Of aligning the left and right hemisphere. That's sort of in line with a lot of your work, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, we use most of the stuff we use uses light and sound just because light seems to have a stronger impact on the brain. But it's the same concept, right? Like if you flicker lights on and off in that eye set at a certain rate. So look, let's just say 6 times a second that the lights are flickering on and on 6 times a second, your brain will start following that pattern. And 6 hertz is theta, right? So, you know, it's one of the brain waves that we see a lot with healers and psychics and mediums is this theta brain wave. And so you can actually induce that. You can actually kind of nudge the brain into that state because it'll follow the frequency. And that's what a lot of the audio programs are doing as well, is they're, you know, they're using different ways to kind of trick the brain into moving into different brainwave states, you know? So yeah, it's very clever.
Yeah. I guess it's a good question to ask you. We're doing this now for so many years, you know, with your work. What's your opinion? Do you think the mediums always tell us that everybody has some degree of intuitive ability? Do you believe that?
Yes. And so, of course, I said that with a pause. So, at this point in my sort of journey, I agree with the statement that this is a natural ability, that everybody has the potential to be psychic, if we want to call it that, or to be intuitive, right, on a more general sense. And what I also suspect is that it exists on a continuum, just like everything else, right? So you've got like the folks that work with Forever Family who they're on this end of the continuum, right? Like they're super intuitive, super tapped in. And then you got people who, you know, a little more dense, right? You know, it's like it's harder to hear that subtle information. And I suspect most of us live somewhere in the middle. And, you know, so there's certain days, right? Like, and you've had these experiences where, you know, maybe normally you don't get information, but then all of a sudden you get an insight or you get a download or something happens and it's like, oh, or a premonition or something, right?
Right. Yeah. I know that I'm useless when I'm conscious, but when I'm in the dream state, sometimes I'll get information. So, you know, but I think that, you know, like the music analogy a lot of people make, and I think it's somewhat true. I mean, you could pretty much teach anybody to play a musical instrument rudimentally, you know, but they're never going to be able to give a concert, you know. So, right. But I know people can do exercises and take courses and so forth. I mean, the mediums, like you mentioned, like the Forever Family Foundation mediums, I think that they were born with, you know, greatly enhanced, you know, abilities. I don't think that somebody with average intuitive or mediumistic ability could ever reach that level through training, you know, but everybody has different opinions on that. You've done a lot of work with psychokinesis, the, you know, mind affecting matter. I think you also wrote about healing, distant healing. I mean, distant healing, like such as the power of prayer. I mean, that's psychokinesis, right? It's the mind, affecting matter. So
yeah,
as far as you're concerned, this is a real phenomenon.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, even though, you know, I think it only got one chapter in the book, but it's actually one of my favorite things to look at. And I think partially because I think it's one of the things I have more skill in, right? You know, kind of like you said, like I'm never going to be a medium, right? Like that's just not going to happen. And I have to work really hard to, get my intuitive psychic skills on track. You know, if I practice and I practice and I practice and I practice, I can get pretty good, but it's a lot of work, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
But the psychokinesis and the energy healing seems to come more naturally for me. And so I think, you know, that's probably partly why I really gravitate toward that. But yes, I think it is a real thing. I kind of know it is, right? Because I've seen I've seen enough stuff, and I've, you know, had my own experiences where clearly there's something going on there. In fact, I'm doing a little research study right now with random event generators, and it's been very interesting. I'm still collecting the data, but seeing how these things behave or don't behave is very intriguing, and, you know, also sort of mind-boggling, because it's kind of like, okay, there's clearly a lot of mystery here, right? Like, you know, how this stuff works.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, with regard to psychokinesis, I mean, you know, from doing the work with mediums and being at the various conferences and so forth, that people report all these anecdotal, you know, after-death communications, and a lot of them involves manipulation of energy from a discarnate source. And that's psychokinesis, because a person may not have a body anymore, not in the physical world, but they still have a mind or a consciousness, and they're able to use that to affect physical matter, even, you know, in our, you know, dimension. So, so it's, I mean, that I think that there's an example of psychokinesis that goes beyond the body, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, essentially, that's how mediumship is a telepathic process, right? Just that one person still has a mind or a consciousness, but they don't have a physical body, and yet they still communicate mind to mind, you know? So
yeah,
that stuff. Do you think that, this may not be your area of expertise, but I mean, we know that there are the Earth has magnetic fields, you know, that surround it. Do you think that that could either help or hinder the reception of or transmission non-local, non-physical, you know, information? I mean, might that have an effect?
I think it does. And it's, you know, it's not an area that I'm fully versed in, but, you know, it's interesting because we're kind of getting into this area of, you know, electromagnetic energy, right? Cause we're talking about psychokinesis with sort of discarnate beings, and, you know, what do they tend to usually manipulate? It's sort of electronics. Right. It's like that seems to be the easiest thing for them to manipulate in this sort of physical world. And it's energy. Right. And they're able to sort of move this energy around. And I think it was Dean Radin in one of his books. You know, he talked about some research looking at, you know, like solar flares and the impact that had on people's psi abilities. And I'm not going to remember the results, but there was something significant there. And more recently, right, we had a bunch of solar flare activity, just like, what was it, last week or the week before?
Yeah.
And it was funny because I was collecting this REG data, this random event generated data, and I was collecting dummy data is what I'm calling it, because instead of anybody trying to influence it, I would just run a session and ignore it and like play on my phone or something while it was, you know, running, and, you know, just to get like kind of a control. Right. Like, okay, nobody's trying to do anything. And there was like 3 days in a row where I kept getting significant results, like over and over and over. And I'm like, oh my God, like I'm trying to ignore this thing. Right. But it's like, and it happened to be the same time when all the solar flare stuff was going on. And yeah. So it made me wonder. I'm like, I wonder if somehow it's enhancing my connection to this system, even though I'm trying to ignore it. You know, it's, you know, space time doesn't work like that. And, yeah. You know, maybe it's amping up the effect, even though I'm not looking for it, you know?
Yeah, it could be. And you know, you work with the random number generators. I mean, as you know, the Pear Lab at Princeton and the Global Consciousness, you know, project, and these RNGs set up, you know, in 70 countries all over the world.
Yeah.
And then when certain world events happen, you know, that they all start spiking. It just shows you how connected we really are. You know,
yeah,
we don't realize it. You know, but we're connected to everybody. So I mean, that work must be fascinating. One thing I wanted to ask you, I mean, you know that a lot of people especially in the work that we do, they describe having these dream visitations, you know, visits from their deceased loved ones. And, you know, dream visitations are always described as being very different than so-called regular dreams, you know, regular dreams being disjointed and you don't remember them, you know, and dream visitations are very tactile. So when people have these visitations, we talked earlier about the brain's kind of being set aside or stepping out of the way. You think that might open up a conduit for the reception of these visitations?
Yeah, that's, I mean, I've not really thought about that actually, but you know, as you say it, that makes a lot of sense. And what would be really curious is if we could figure out what stage of sleep people are in when they experience this, you know, because, you know, because obviously, you know, our brain waves are kind of shifting throughout the night in different stages of sleep, you know, from a deeper level of sleep, hopefully, right? We all need that, which is dominated by delta. And when we're in a delta state, we can't remember anything, right? It's like we're very unconscious. But theta, you know, a lot of time in our sleep, we're kind of cruising through theta. And, you know, we already mentioned theta, that theta is this interesting brainwave that seems to be, you know, more open and grants us more access to all kinds of things, including energy and healing and hypnosis and all kinds of things. And so it'd be interesting to, if there's a way, I mean, there's surely there's a way to study it, right? But to see if that's what's happening. People are in a particularly open, receptive state. And, you know, that's when they're able to kind of like make that connection. I mean, I'm speculating. Who knows, right?
Yeah, well, that would be really interesting, like you say. But I guess from a research perspective, you know, it'd be like dream studies. But it's hard enough doing a dream study for these regular dreams. And, you know, but then how are you there at the same time they're having one of these presentations? Right. You know, these things are spontaneous in nature. So it's like a researcher's nightmare. But that really would be interesting if you could. If you could measure that.
Well, I mean, you know, what else is interesting, and it may be related, but the other brainwave that shows up a lot with psychic mediums, whatever, is gamma. So it's kind of like this really slow brainwave theta, and then the fastest brainwave gamma. And a lot of times they show up together. There's been research showing that gamma spikes during lucid dreaming. So even though you're asleep, it's like the brain is cranked up into this really fast space. You know, we might even want to call it a higher vibration, you know. And so, you know, that'd be curious too, right? Like if people are having these dream visitations, is it also some of this gamma going on?
Yeah. All right. Well, we just have your whole next year planned for a new research
protocol. next 10 years.
Yeah. So, listen, we've been talking with Dr. Jeff Tarrant. His book, we only touched on the stuff that's in his book, Becoming Psychic, Lessons from the Minds of Mediums, Healers, and Psychics. For those of you watching it on video, I have a copy of it here, but here we go. But you can learn more about Jeff and probably have your contact information on a website, neuromeditationinstitute.com. And Neuro is N-E-U-R-O, MeditationInstitute.com. So thank you so much for being with us, Jeff. Look forward to, I know you're going to be at our grief retreat in July, so that, yep. I'm looking forward to that.
Looking forward to it.
So it'll be good seeing you again, and thanks so much. Keep up the good work, and have a good rest of the night.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, and see you soon.
Yes, all right, thanks.
All right.
Take care. Good night, everyone.